We're going to be in Exodus chapter 16 this morning. So if you have a Bible or a Bible app, go ahead and open up to Exodus chapter 16. We're going to work through the entire chapter. And I'm hoping that I can keep this within our time constraints because we do have another gathering that's coming in after this. And I want to be able to like not rush through it, give it ample time, but hopefully not try to point out every single little detail that's in the text. But while you're turning there, I want to point out that this is nothing new, but I read an article over this past week. It was written back in December in the Washington Times, and the article was titled, Fathers Disappear from Households Across America. Okay, nothing new. It's not really news. It's still being published, but the dramatic increase in fatherlessness in our culture is staggering. It's unbelievable, and it's unprecedented historically. This has not typically happened. And what's happening is that the correspondence in fatherlessness in particular and drugs and violent crime and poverty are increasing on a similar rate. And that's what this article was about. And so what the article pointed out was that nationally, a third of American children live without a father. And that problem of fatherlessness is concentrated around urban areas. Now, the measurement they are applying is simply fathers aren't in the home. They're not involved in the lives. Now, some of us grew up in homes where dad was there, right? But he wasn't there, right? Some of us from those types of homes, he's there, but he's not there. And so maybe this number is a little too small in terms of fatherlessness, because many of us have had daddies in the home, but they haven't really been daddy. They've been that guy that is sort of around. And for some of us, it's not a pleasant thing for dad to be around. In Walnut Hills, this neighborhood, 11% of the children live in a home where there's a mom and a dad present. 11%. 1 in 10. Right now, generally speaking, it's not much better around the urban core of Cincinnati. So the neighborhoods that we go to school in, that we work in, that we recreate in, all these neighborhoods, the best of these neighborhoods has about 43%. So less than half of our children have a mom and a dad in their home. Some of that's intentional, which I think is abusive and sick. But there isn't a neighborhood in the urban core of Cincinnati where the children, over 50% of the children, live with both parents. Fatherlessness is an epidemic. And like I've said, the increase in social problems like drugs and crime and poverty, that's one thing. And that's certainly an issue. And I don't have all the answers for that. But I know it takes a toll not just sociologically, but also personally. Right? We are a culture, particularly in urban areas, that feel like dad has abandoned us. We have this feeling that there isn't a father to provide, to love, and to guide because he's not around. That he's been there to bring us to where we are, and then he's checked out. And many of us know this personally. Not just sociologically. It's not just out there. It's in here. It's in our hearts. It's our story. And it's a story that the Israelites were struggling with. That they had this God who showed up and said, I'm your father, you're my son, and he's brought them to a certain place. And for whatever reason, like time after time after time, as they're wandering through this wilderness of life, they look out and they wonder, has God our Father abandoned us? Has he left us? Right? And so for many of us, that's what we project onto God, and the Israelites are the same. If dad is gone and he's sort of my representation of what the father is like and he's not around, well, has God abandoned us too? And we've simply responded in kind, and we've just fled from the church community, and we're not really embracing family, and we're redefining everything. And this experiment, who knows where it's going to end. But here's what happens in the story of Israel. When we're left wondering, has God, who brought us to this place, abandoned us? Chapter 16 of Exodus, verse 1. They set out from Elim. Let me stop really quickly and just remind you. They had been in the wilderness, right? They complained about their thirst. God provided for them. And then they went to Elim where there was water and there were palm trees and life was good. And so they're not there for long. They end chapter 15 with being at Elim, and then they start chapter 16 as leaving from there back into the wilderness, right? So they set out from Elim, and all the congregation of the people of Israel came to the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after they had departed from the land of Egypt. And the whole congregation of the people of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. And the people of Israel said to them, "Would that we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the meat pots and ate bread to the full. For you have brought us out into the wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger," right? So the setting, they're moving away from a place of brief rest back into the wilderness on their way to the promised land, right? And we've talked about this up to this point in Exodus, that God tends to allow the majority of our life to be spent wandering in the uncertainty of the wilderness, right? It's not mountaintop after mountaintop. It's the mundane. Where are we every day? There doesn't seem to always be enough provision. There doesn't seem to be enough time. We're kind of wandering through the wilderness together. And so the people are between Elim, which was a place of rest, and Sinai, where they're going to get this other encounter with God. They've been free for about a month and a half, right? So it's rare in this month and a half, it's rare for God to let his people stay at a place of rest for long. Many of us know this, don't we? But we know that rest isn't a normal part of our life and rhythm. It's very rare for God to just allow us to sit there where we have plenty. Now, in our culture, maybe we're a little more used to that because we have so much that we can extend that livelihood, that rest, that place of rest. But for the majority of people in the world, and even the majority of us, even just emotionally, the Lord doesn't always allow us to linger in a place of rest for too terribly wrong. And so what do? They grumble, right? Israel grumbles. "I wish we were dead. It would be better for us to have died in Egypt than to be out here and to die of hunger. We're going to die, so why are we doing it out here suffering and struggling," right? And many of us know that heart's cry very well, don't we? We know it because we look back to what it was like before God interfered with our lives. That's definitely the story of the people at Missio, right? We don't try to proclaim this gospel that if you come to Jesus, life will be grand and perfect and he'll pay all of your bills and take care of all of your health, right? For many of us, we had it made, and then we start walking with Jesus. Suddenly we have to care for people. Suddenly we have to let people in, and all of a sudden Jesus is completely making a mess of our nice, clean lives, right? Isn't that the story of most of us at Missio? I think it's the story of most of us. We're just trying to be really honest about that, right? So that's what's going on. This look back into slavery eats their lunch. It starts to crumble their souls. They're like, it was better then. And that sounds so absurd, right? They're being whipped and beaten and they're treated as slaves and they have no freedom. And they're saying, but that was better than this sort of freedom. This isn't what I expected. Lord, you've got to do something. So what are they complaining about? So I was reading this and I was like, okay, I mean, I understand, right? I talked about my hunger grump last week, and if I don't have food, I could not sleep for days and I'll be fine. But if I don't eat for a couple of hours, you don't want to be around me. I get my hunger grump. So I kind of understand where they're coming from. But then I realize what they're angry and upset and grumbling about isn't predominantly just hunger. What they say is that formerly they sat at the meat pots and they ate their fill, right? It isn't so much that they are hungry now and they weren't hungry then. It's that the way food came in, the way provision came in, they weren't required to work for that provision. It was provided for them. Now they're out in the wilderness. Now they're out slugging it out, looking out for one another. Now they've got investment. And they're not able to just sit and have food provided for them, even though it was probably meager as a slave economy. Like, they weren't being provided lush foods. They're saying that was better. Why? Because they sat and ate their fill. The desire on the heart of the people is to rest and to receive provision. And as we read on in this story, that's going to become the key. that what they want to do is they want to sit and eat their fill. They don't want to keep wandering. They don't want to keep journeying. They just want to stop and rest and have it all lavished upon them. Now, once again, like it was in chapter 15, the complaint is aimed at Moses and Aaron, right? The two men that are stepping up to help. They're stepping up to lead. They're stepping up to take responsibility. And the people grumble at them. You have brought us out here to kill us. It would have been better for the Lord to kill us back there. But you've brought us out here. You're going to kill us with hunger. And they take shots at God's leaders, which is not uncommon. And so what happens? The Lord speaks. And he gives a word of comfort to Moses. And here's what he says. I'm going to read verses 4 to 12. The Lord said to Moses, "Behold, I am about to rain bread from heaven for you. And all the people shall go out and gather a day's portion every day, that I may test them whether they will walk in my law or not. On the sixth day, when they prepare what they bring in, it will be twice as much as they gather daily." So Moses and Aaron said to all the people of Israel, "At evening you shall know that it was the Lord who brought you out of the land of Egypt. And in the morning you shall see the glory of the Lord, because he has heard your grumbling against the Lord. For what are we that you grumble against us?" And Moses said, "When the Lord gives you in the evening meat to eat, and in the morning bread to the full, because the Lord has heard your grumbling, that you grumble against him, what are we? Your grumbling is not against us, but against the Lord." Then Moses said to Aaron, "Say to the whole congregation of the people of Israel, come near before the Lord, for he has heard your grumbling." And as soon as Aaron spoke to the whole congregation of the people of Israel, they looked toward the wilderness, and behold, the glory of the Lord appeared in the cloud. And the Lord said to Moses, "I have heard the grumbling of the people of Israel. Say to them, at twilight you shall eat meat, and in the morning you shall be filled with bread. Then you shall know that I am the Lord your God." It seems like as we're reading that, it's the same thing over and over, right? And I think it's the same thing over and over because we're a little thick and we're slow to get what God is trying to tell us. We're quick to grumble. We're slow to see that he provides. And so God seems to say the same thing over and over. But what he starts with, I love it. He says, "I'm going to rain bread down on you from heaven. I'm going to rain it down. I know you're grumbling about wanting to sit there and have your provision. So guess what? I'm not going to just answer your grumbling to satisfy your grumbling. I'm going to answer your grumbling to satisfy your desire to see something spectacular, which is the glory and the grace of God." And so God provides for us, for his people, above all that we ask or think, doesn't he? You want bread? I'll make you sick with it. I'm going to rain it down from heaven. You will have bread, and I'm going to do this not because I see your grumbling, and I think that if I satisfy that grumbling, you're never going to grumble again, because we're prone to grumbling. That's why it keeps happening over and over and over again. But he satisfies it so that they see how good God is, and his provisions are more than what we think that we need. That's a good thing. He says, this is the way we're going to do this. I'm going to provide for you. Don't ever forget that. And he tells Moses, and Moses tells Aaron, and Aaron tells the people, hey, God's going to provide, and stop grumbling. God is going to provide. What's happening here is that the people are sort of concealing their unbelief in God by directing it at God's leaders. Like I said, this is not an uncommon thing. What ends up happening is when you get into higher profiles, the more people that you take responsibility for, the more people that you say, I will be like Jesus for them. I will lay down my life for them as much as is in me, I'm capable of doing, people will take shots. There are always critics. There will always be critics. One famous pastor said it this way. He said, when you call the shots, you take the shots. And I love what Moses and Aaron do. They do what's unlike what unlike many of us would do. As we're taking the shots, what we have a tendency to do is protect ourselves, cover ourselves, make excuses, fight back. What they do instead is what we're supposed to do. They remind people of the promises of God. They don't take this personally, right? They recognize God has put me here. And so if you're angry, your grumbling isn't at me. I'm not the one that dreamed this thing up like he is. So he's heard your grumbling. Guess what he's going to do? He's going to bless you for it because that's who God is. But they don't take the grumbling and get personal and start complaining about their rights and their freedoms. They say, no, come near and look at what the Lord is about to do. And I love that. I love that he says, come near. Come near, right? Come listen. You're far away. That's obvious. And so Moses says, come near. Let's hear what the heart of the Lord is. Right? And I think that's a great general principle for all of us. Come near, right? If you're grumbling and complaining, because most of us, when we grumble and complain, where do we do it from? We do it from a distance, don't we? Either a physical distance or some sort of emotional disconnect. And we grumble a lot when we don't know the people that we're grumbling against. It's very easy. And so Moses says, no, come on near. Hear what's going on. See the glory. Watch him provide. Look at his presence. Look at how he leads. And hopefully that will be harder for the people to grumble about, right? And this is why I am fully committed to, I will never make comments on any news stories. Because all they are is just a big complaint fest. I don't even know why people open that up, right? It's like, who really cares what the masses think? It basically boils down to pooled ignorance, doesn't it? I mean, it's argument and name-calling and ridiculousness. And the reason why we're able to do that is because we grumble and complain very easily from a distance. That won't happen face-to-face, typically. I know some people are, yeah, it's going to happen. But for most people, most sensible people, they hear an argument, they're not going to say some of the things to somebody's face that they would type. And the reason they feel safety in doing that is because there's a distance. And so what I'm saying is get rid of the comments section, come on near, right? Come on, let's talk about this, right? This is the Old Testament version of do not type in the comments section of your newspaper. Good? That's what's going on. Come near. Come near. And we need to draw people near, both in the good and the bad. I do this with my kids all the time. Right? I try. I mean, I fail at this sometimes, but I don't yell up the stairs for my kids to come down. I'll go to their little switch at the bottom of the steps and I'll flicker it. And they know when daddy's flickering the lights, come to the top of the steps. So I don't have to yell. I want them to come near. I want them to see my face. I want them to, you know, and if I'm correcting them, I try not to take a really aggressive stance where I tower over them. I get down on a knee. I look them in the eye. I put my hand on a shoulder. I say, come near. Listen to what I have to say. Sometimes it's for something good. Hey, I'm proud of you. I love the way you boys loved on your neighbor Blake and the way that you played with him and encouraged him. I love the way that you represented Jesus and life to him. That was good. I don't do that from a towering, distant position. I do it by coming near. When I have to correct them about something, I get down on their level. I look them in the eye. I put my hand on their shoulder. I tell them, I love you. Listen, this isn't acceptable. Right? We need to do more of this. When we have those hurt feelings, we need to come near. We need to look at one another in the eye. We need to say things that matter and not just spout off and get distant and further apart and grow cold. The Lord says, no, come near and see what he's doing. Then we come to really what is the heart of this text. And so I'm going to read a large chunk, verses 13 to 30. And God is going to come through on his promise. Right? He's promised meat in the evening, bread in the morning. He's going to come through on that promise and he's going to sort of give a call for the people to respond. Verse 13. In the evening, quail came up, covered the camp. And in the morning, dew lay around the camp. And when the dew had gone up, there was on the face of the wilderness a fine flake-like thing, fine as frost on the ground. When the people saw it, they said to one another, what is it? For they did not know what it was, which is a great question to ask when you don't know what something is. And Moses said to them, it is the bread that the Lord has given you to eat. This is what the Lord has commanded. Gather of it, each of you, as much as he can eat. You shall each take an omer according to the number of the persons that each of you has in his tent. And the people of Israel did so. They gathered some more, some less. But when they measured it with an omer, whoever gathered much had nothing left over. And whoever gathered little had no lack. Each of them gathered as much as he could eat. And Moses said to them, let no one leave any of it over till the morning. But they did not listen to Moses. Some left part of it till the morning, and it bred worms and stank. And Moses was angry with them. Morning by morning they gathered it, each as much as he could eat. But when the sun grew hot, it melted. On the sixth day, they gathered twice as much bread, two omers each. And when all the leaders of the congregation came and told Moses, he said to them, this is what the Lord has commanded. Tomorrow is a day of solemn rest, a holy Sabbath to the Lord. Bake and boil what you will boil, and all that is left over, lay aside to be kept until the morning. So they laid it aside till the morning, as Moses commanded them. And it did not stink, and there were no worms in it. Moses said, eat it today, for today is a Sabbath to the Lord. Today you will not find it in the field. 6 days you shall gather it, but on the seventh day, which is a Sabbath, there will be none. On the seventh day, some of the people went out to gather, but they found none. And the Lord said to Moses, how long will you refuse to keep my law or my commandments and my laws? See, the Lord has given you the Sabbath. Therefore, on the sixth day, he gives you bread for 2 days. Remain each of you in his place. Let no one go out of his place on the seventh day. So the people rested on the seventh day. I say this is the heart of the text. Because what Jesus, what God in Christ and what God is doing in the world is he's trying to teach us specifically here that manna, this food that he provides for his people, particularly in this story, is more than just bread. It's more than bread, right? In Psalm 78, it declares that manna is the grain of heaven and the bread of angels. And then Deuteronomy 8:3 says this, when recounting this particular story, Moses says he humbled you and let you hunger and fed you with manna, which you did not know, nor did your fathers know, that he might make you know that man does not live by bread alone, but man lives by every word that comes from the mouth of the Lord. So manna involves bread, but it points to something else. It points to something greater. So manna involves bread, but it is more than just bread. God's provision, the way he provides for us, the way he gives us the sustenance that we need, the things that we need to live by, are not just things that fall out of the sky. He invites us to participate in gathering and preparing and resting. And so manna is not just working and it's not just food. It's this rhythm of work and rest. And it's something that we're supposed to do on a daily basis, right? It's fresh provision daily. We express our trust as we work and rest daily, as we have good rhythms of work and rest. That's what God is trying to teach his people through the manna, to teach them that you don't live by just making a living. You don't live by bread alone. You don't live by just going to work, that there's something more to this, that there's life in participating with God in working and resting, right? Some of the people, they gather and rest. Some don't. Some take too much. And they try to hoard for themselves additional manna, more than what they can eat. And God says, no, I'm not going to let that stay until the next morning. You're not working to hoard. You're not working to be selfish. You're working for provision. You're working as an act of worship toward me, and I will provide what you need. So we're not here to stockpile a bunch of stuff, right? So some people, that's all they do. They work, 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 work. Other people, right, and they refuse to rest. So other people, they refuse that second aspect. They don't gather enough for the Sabbath. But what God is doing here is sort of indicting all of us, right? We're all Israel in the wilderness. We're all these types of people, right? We are a faithless people reluctant to trust the Lord on a daily basis in doing what we do. We don't often participate with what God is doing, right? Some of us believe that work and rest are a curse, don't we? Those rhythms that we're supposed to have, that God has hardwired into our souls, we look at that and we say, no, that's a curse. Now, for some of us, we tend to view work as a curse and rest as glory, don't we? Some of us, that's work is a curse, and we're working for the weekend, right? Everybody's working for the weekend. Am I the only one? All right. But some of us, we tend to view work as a curse and rest as glory, or we tend to view rest as a curse and we view work as glory, right? Some of us detest our work and we complain with Israel, and all we want to do is just sit by the pots and eat our fill. Right? Work is a curse. It's a problem for us. We long for a day where we can just sit and have our fill. We believe that ambition and accomplishment in life is an evil. And so we believe that work is a curse. For some of us, we believe that work is not a curse, that rest is a curse, or that work and rest determine our worth. And so we work to justify ourselves or to give ourselves an identity. Right? Think about the way that we talk to little kids about work when they're little. What do we ask them? What do you want to be when you grow up? And usually what we're asking is, what do you want to do when you grow up? But we're from a very young age, we're tying identity with our work from a very young age. And that's backwards, isn't it? We don't get our identity from our work. We get our identity from being created in God's image. But for so many of us, we view rest as a curse and we work to build an identity for ourselves. And so we're trying to change that in our home. And so that's one of the things that we ask. Hey, kids, what do you want to do when you grow up? Not what do you want to be. What I want you to be is a God-fearing man who loves the people around him, or a God-fearing woman who loves it. That's who you are. Now, what do? Oh, you're a fireman. That's great. That's a great ambition. But that's not who you are. It's what you do. And so when we work to buy an identity, we often do it through recreation. We live for the weekend, and we find ourselves in opposition to what God is trying to teach us. And he goes on. He gives us this last little instruction, verse 31. Now the house of Israel called its name manna. It was like coriander seed, white, and the taste of it was like wafers made with honey. Moses said, this is what the Lord has commanded. Let an omer of it be kept throughout your generations, so that they may see the bread with which I fed you in the wilderness when I brought you out of the land of Egypt. And Moses said to Aaron, take a jar and put an omer of manna in it. Place it before the Lord to be kept throughout your generations. As the Lord commanded Moses, so Aaron placed it before the testimony to be kept. The people of Israel ate the manna 40 years till they came to a habitable land. They ate the manna till they came to the border of the land of Canaan. And then this little parenthetic, an omer is the 10th part of an ephah, in case you were wondering. Right? And so God continually, as long as we're in the wilderness, as long as we haven't arrived at the promised land, he's going to feed us with manna. Manna is more than just bread. It's this participation with him through rhythms of work and rest. And we don't do that very well, right? They keep the day's portion to be reminded that God's provision is a daily provision. And then to preserve this means that we constantly remind ourselves of God's provision, that it comes daily and then invites us to participate. So this text is much bigger than hunger and bread, right? Do we see that? It's bigger than hunger and bread. Manna points to more. God invites us to participate with him in the provision of our needs through working and resting. And here's our difficulty. Jesus looks at a crowd of people like us, and he says, not so much that you're just a bunch of lazy fools, because some of us are very hardworking, right? Like I said, some of us view rest as a curse. But here's what he says in John chapter 6. If you have a Bible, flip there. John chapter 6. I'm going to park here for a few minutes. But what he tells us is that we work for food that perishes. We work for food that perishes. What does that mean? Let's listen to Jesus' words. John 6, verse 26. Crowd following across the river. Jesus answered them, truly, truly, I say to you, you're seeking me, not because you saw signs, but because you ate your fill of the loaves. Do not labor for the food that perishes, but for the food that endures to eternal life, which the Son of Man will give you. For on him God the Father has set his seal. Then they said to him, what must we do to be doing the works of God? And Jesus answered them, this is the work of God, that you believe in him whom he has sent. So they said to him, then what sign do you do that we may see and believe you? What work do you perform? Our fathers ate manna in the wilderness. As it is written, he gave them bread from heaven to eat. Jesus then said to them, truly, truly, I say to you, it was not Moses who gave you bread from heaven, but my Father gives you the true bread from heaven. For the bread of God is he who comes down from heaven and gives life to the world. They said to him, sir, give us this bread always. Jesus said to them, I am the bread of life. Whoever comes to me shall not hunger, and whoever believes in me shall never thirst. So people work for bread that perishes. And Jesus invites us in to something so much better. In John 6, the people follow and they grumble because they don't have, or because they have bread, right? They're grumbling. They have bread, but they want bread that leads to something else. Israel grumbled because they didn't have bread, but we're all grumbling, whether we have provision or whether we don't have provision. And here's what Jesus doesn't say. He doesn't say stop working, right? He doesn't say that. He doesn't say quit your jobs and be a part of the vocational ministry. And for many of you, you've grown up in churches where you've been told the only way to do things that count for the Lord is to do them when you get paid as a minister to do them. If the only reason I do this is because I can't get out of it, right? If I had it my way, I would probably like be involved in real estate and doing houses, flipping, renovation. I'd take Justin. He'd be my design guy. We'd go out and flip houses and we'd make a killing, right? Or we'd lose our shirts. I don't know. That's probably what I'd be doing, right? I do this because every attempt I make at getting away from ministry, I kind of feel sucked back into it. Like I can't leave it. And it's not that I don't desire to do this. But for many churches and many, many services I've heard pastors get up and go on and on about how they were working in the real world, and then God called them to ministry, and now they're doing what they were created to do. And when I hear that, all I hear is, you couldn't hack it in the real world, so now you're hiding in ministry. And that's the reality. And that's really what's going on. A lot of the guys that pastor churches, they pastor churches because they can't do anything else. And there's a lot of people that are looking at life and they're saying, what do I want to be when I grow up? Well, I don't know. But I was at a church service once when I was 5, and a little old lady came up to me and patted me on the head, and she said, you're going to be a minister someday. And so that's what I'm going to do, because I don't know what else to do. And I just want to like scream from the rooftops. No, what you do out there every day, that manna that you're participating in, that work and that rest, is of eternal significance. Like what we do here, it's important, yes, but it's not more important than what goes on out there. And if you have any familiarity with church history, the church makes its move through its people, not so much through its leaders. My role is to equip the saints to do the work of the ministry. And we don't do it in here, we do it out there. And so work is meaningful and it's significant. And if you can get away from doing church ministry, do that. Do that thing. And I think some of you need to hear, like, oh, wow, here's a church that doesn't think that that's the ultimate calling. Maybe the ultimate calling is to work for GE. Maybe the ultimate calling is to work for P&G. Maybe, or some other, like, abbreviated company. but maybe the Lord is doing, so he doesn't say stop working and join me in full-time ministry. He's talking to the multitudes. He says what needs to change is your motivation for work. It's got to point to something bigger. What we work for must point to something larger than it does currently. And for most of us, that doesn't happen. We're working for the weekend. We're working for an identity. We're working for things that perish. And Jesus says, I am the bread of life. Let me provide for you sustenance, identity. Let me take care of your needs. And now I want to invite you to participate. And so what we can do becomes an act of worship. God isn't just feeding his people, but he's teaching them about himself. He is the source of life. He restores the proper place of work. We don't work or rest to establish our value. Jesus establishes our value. We work believing his provision. What's the work of God? Believing that he provides for us. That's the work that we do. And then everything else becomes an act of imaging God. Right? So what do we do? I've got 3 points of sort of application here. Because Jesus is alive, because he forgives us for trying to make an identity in work and in rest, because he is alive again, his spirit empowers us to, number one, trust God daily. This needs to be done on a daily basis, right? Some of you will go good for about a week, maybe even a month. But it's not going to last forever. You need a daily provision. What you've been doing in your work, in your rest, You need a constant reminder of that. You need that to be fueled into your soul on a daily basis. And we express this when we work daily and rest daily, when we establish good daily rhythms, right? If you look at the pattern in Genesis, there's evening, there's morning, the first day, which should teach us that your day of work is really influenced by your night of rest and your night of preparation. Oh, I could go on all day about how we need to get good sleep, how we need to take care of ourselves, how we need to plan for the next day. And we try to establish rhythms in our lives like that. Sunday, the first day of the week, my wife and I, we block out some time. We sit on the couch. We open our calendars and we just plan. Here's what's going on this week. Here are the meetings I have. Here are the times I'm going to be out in the evening. Here are the nights, which is usually three nights a week, where people are going to be in our home. Here's when we're going to go see Blake. Here's and we, you know, it takes effort. You've got to do that before it comes. Then she spends some time. We make the kids lay their clothes out the night before. We make lunches so that when we get up without this rush of the day. We're not trying to catch up. We've prepared the night before. The evening and the morning form the first day. Try to get a lot of rest, and that you got to take care of yourself. You do this daily. If you don't do it daily, it catches up to you. I heard a story on NPR just this past week that was talking about a sort of a sleep deficit that we create. And it talked about how human beings need about, adult humans need about 8 hours of sleep per night on average. That's what we need. If you get less than that, you need to make up for it sometime. If you don't do that intentionally by sleeping, your body will do that intentionally by breaking down on you. But you need about 8 hours. And so if you get an average of 6, you need to catch up on the weekends. If that's not possible for you, we need to look at, where are you finding your identity? Why are you striving so hard? What's going on? You need to be someone who rests and does this on a daily basis and work on a daily basis. So that brings us to our second point. We trust God daily. We do this through working and resting. Second point of application, work hard. Man, God created us to participate with Him in work. Work and rest are not a curse. They're there before the curse. God created us to image Him, to work hard with Him, to cultivate, to take responsibility, right? To develop things, to make the best of them, to take something that's chaotic and make it less so, so that it shines for God's glory. One of the ways that we image God, according to creation story, is through our work, gathering the provision of God and using it for the purpose of declaring His goodness to us. Now, while this has been lost in the fall and in the curse, Jesus restores it, so we can do it without work defining us or without us rejecting work. So one of the ways that I think that we can work hard is we need to rethink ambition a little bit. I think we have some skewed ideas on what ambition is. Selfish ambition, like this desire to make a name for ourselves, it's always wrong. It's always condemned in the Bible. You don't work to make a name for yourself. God-focused ambition. God-focused vision. The things where you're like, I feel like the Lord is impressing on me to do this. The only way that this is going to happen is if he shows up. That kind of ambition is not selfish and sinful. That's worship. Right? And so maybe some of us need to distinguish between a dream and a vision, right? A vision is a dream that's being played out. Right? Some of us are dreamers. We're like, hey, I want to see this happen. Okay, what are you doing about that? Because that's when your dream becomes a vision. And when those visions are God-sized, those become acts of worship. And those are very good things. Like, God never corrects anybody for ambition. He doesn't look at David or Solomon and say, oh, you want to build a holy temple for me? No, that's selfish. No, it's for Him. It's, of course, I'm going to bless that. Let's do this together. And it blesses a whole nation of people. And so we need to rescue that ambition and see our work as an opportunity to worship. Whatever you do, there's nothing meaningless. Everybody has a part. And as we start to go even more through the Exodus story, He's going to start talking about some of the people that don't get mentioned a lot in Scripture, the craftsmen and the people that work with their hands and the artists and the people that are doing kind of everyday things. You don't see that highlighted. You're going to see a lot in Exodus as God calls forth His people. And then finally, we trust God, we work hard. Thirdly, we rest joyfully. Rest takes preparation and intentionality. The reason most of us don't pray, the reason most of us don't rest, the reason that most of us don't do the things that we feel like we should be doing is we simply fail to plan to do it. We don't do things with intentionality or purpose. We just kind of let life come as it comes and take us as it takes us. So one of the ways we can do this, guard your time. For my family, we guard generally most Sunday evenings. There are two Sundays of the month where I'm out. But generally speaking, on Sunday nights, we're at home and we do our calendar meeting, right? Twice a month, I meet with my elders. Once a month, I meet with my elders. And then once a month, we have a Connexus meeting, meet with mission group leaders, talk about things that are going on. But we guard Sunday nights. Then we guard Monday nights as well. And that's for family worship. Right? And we have to plan for that because we've got to get started at a good time so that we can eat on time, so we can get the kids to bed on time, so that Shannon and I can have our time on Monday evenings. And then we try to guard Saturday mornings as well. Right? Those are our three times a week that we, generally speaking, we guard that. And that's family time. My kids don't always love that because their friends come up on Saturday mornings and we're like, no, it's family time. And sometimes sports gets in the way in that. But you have to guard your time, right? You can't get anything done if you don't guard out blocks of time to do that. And in order to rest well, we need to prepare for it. This is why God gives the provision to the Exodus folks. You need to gather on Saturday what you're going to eat on Sunday. It has to be planned for in advance. Sabbath is not a day to go hungry and mourn. You are supposed to plan for it, right? It's not supposed to be a day of misery and, oh, I'm just sacrificing and suffering for the Lord. No, he's made a way for you to enjoy it, but he wants you to plan for it and rest in it. Get all your ducks in a row. Pay all your bills. Let it be a day of rest and play. And I guarantee that the joy in your home, that the joy in your life will just increase. You'll feel like the people that you're around are not a distraction from the things that you should get done because you hadn't done them already. There'll be a joy and a pleasure. You'll be able to listen to their stories and offer honest, viable feedback. But we won't do that if we don't rest and if we don't do it joyfully. Prepare for rest with intentionality and purpose. So, in conclusion, I'd say this. God's provision is enjoyed through our rhythms of work and rest. Now, Jesus is the one who provides for us. Clearly, he is the bread of life. He is the thing that sustains us. His spirit in us gives us the freedom to enjoy God's provision of being the bread of life. And so we can walk in that by trusting God, by working hard, and by resting joyfully. That's what we're going to do. I want to give you an opportunity to respond to this. You can do this in three ways. We're going to give you a moment to reflect and to pray, to ask questions. Where do I need to repent? Lord, where do I need to trust more? Where do I need to work harder? Where do we need to prepare to rest? After you've taken a moment to reflect and pray, we're going to invite you forward to partake of communion. You can do this together. The table is open the entire time, and what you're doing coming forward is you're saying that Jesus is the one that provides my rest. I don't work to get my identity. He does it. His body was broken. His blood was poured out so that my brokenness and my sins are covered, forgiven, healed, and restored. And so you're coming forward saying, I need Jesus for this. We do have wine in the cups. So if you have an aversion to that because of conscience or diet, we invite you to partake of communion by dipping your bread in the bowl, which has juice. If you have a dietary issue with gluten, we have gluten-free bread in the bowls, but we want you to be able to come and freely participate. And the last way you can respond is by singing to one another. It's appropriate to sing the praises of God for the work that he's done. Let me pray. I'll give you a moment to reflect, and our band will lead you through the rest of our time of response. Father, thank you that you do give us these rhythms. It would have been enough for you to rescue us from slavery, but you did not leave us there. You got us, you provide for us, you invite us to participate. You give us manna, which points to the fact that you are the bread of life. And so be the bread of life for us. Help us to trust you daily, to work hard, to rest joyfully. In the name of the Father, Son, and Spirit, amen.